Welcome to Prophecy Radio, the Percy Jackson podcast that will keep you up to date on all things Rick Riordan and Rick Riordan Presents, including upcoming books, adaptations, and more. This is episode number 98.
Woo!
My name is Karen.
And I'm Kristen.
And today we are talking about The Spirit Glass by Roshni Chokshi. We are recording on the 4th. This book does not come out until the 5th. Tomorrow.
Yes.
Yeah, I thought it was the 6th for some reason.
So did I.
But it's definitely the 5th because it comes out on Tuesday. It has to. It's not allowed to come out on another day. That's how books work.
Books always come out on Tuesdays.
Yeah.
Did they delay it because of Labor Day?
Title will be released on September 5th.
Okay. We just thought it was the
6th. We were just wrong. That's fine. So we're recording this early. We usually hold off our discussions of books until like a week or two after, so everybody has a chance to read before they listen. But our schedule right now is a little bit hectic, so we can't do that. So
there's a lot of books coming up and that are coming out like soon.
Yeah.
So covering everything, we had to do some schedule juggling.
Yeah. But it's going to be great, it's going to be fine, and I think we both really enjoyed this book, so hopefully you guys can get your hands on it as soon as possible, and, you know, stick around for the news, stick around for our chapter discussion of The Red Pyramid. If you have to skip the discussion for The Spirit Glass for now, just come back later. That's totally fine. You can do it in whatever order you want.
Yep.
If you'd like to get into contact with us, you can do so at Prophecy Podcast on Twitter, at Prophecy Radio Podcast on Tumblr, Instagram, Threads, and Facebook, and Prophecy Radio Podcast at gmail.com. We do not have a lot of news and updates this week, which is okay. Sometimes we like a chill week. I do want to remind everyone that I was on Seaweed Brain Podcast.
You were!
Yeah!
We may have hinted a little at that last time.
To talk about The Sun and the Star, the Cocoa Puffs chapters of that. So it's near the end. I had a fantastic time. Erica and Carter are both so incredibly nice, and we had some really deep discussions, and I felt like I was getting very philosophical, and it was really awesome. So please, I linked to it last week, I'll link to it again this week. Go check that out if you haven't already, because they are both fantastic.
No seaweed brains on that podcast.
Yeah.
It's all seaweed brains and no seaweed brains at the same time.
Okay, I'm done being cute, so yeah. Okay, and then just a reminder that the Chalice of the Gods book tour is coming up very, very soon. The Chicago and both Texas shows are sold out, but it looks like the other ones still have spots open. I know Becky specifically mentioned the LA tour stop specifically had spots open still. I will link to Rick's blog post where he talks about the tour if you are thinking about going. You should definitely go. And if you're going to Chicago, I will be there, and you should come say hi to me.
We need to get you a button.
Yeah.
Prophecy Radio.
Yeah.
Like,
that's true.
So that
I can wear a button.
Like a button or something that has either our logo or something so that people know it's you.
Yeah.
Because I understand it's weird to just, like, walk up to people you think you might know.
Well,
and
the good thing
like,
is, I have, like, bright pink-orange hair. So,
yes,
like,
that does
helps
stand
a lot.
Out.
And I might bring my Nico hat again, my Cabin 13 hat.
Nice.
So, like, between those two things, it's probably going to be obvious that it's me. But, like, I'm also very shy and awkward and have crazy anxiety. So I understand if people are nervous, but I'm super nice, and
yes,
I might just be as awkward as you are, so.
And that room, to be honest, is going to be filled with a lot of people who are very similar to us. I mean, they're
yes,
Rick Riordan fans, so, you know.
They're probably weirdos.
For the most part, they're going to be nice, gentle weirdos
yes,
who, you know, love the same things you do. So if you accidentally talk to somebody who's the wrong one because someone else has pink and orange hair.
That's true.
They're probably going to say, that's not me, but hi, it's nice to meet you.
Yeah.
And just keep moving. So I wouldn't stress too much.
I always want to be described as a nice, gentle weirdo now. That is like the best thing that's ever been said about me. I love
We're
that.
All just nice, gentle weirdos.
Yes. Reed Riordan posted a couple of articles for the Spirit Glass release that's coming up very, very soon. The first one that they did this week was Meet Florida Lisa, who is the spirit in the book that steals the soul key. I don't think that's too much of a spoiler. And her face is, like, half rotten away and stuff. She's a little bit scary.
Now that I've read it, I can actually look at this, because I was trying not to, like... She is scary.
She is a little scary. She only has one eye. The other one is just a socket, an empty socket. Not very appetizing.
But, I mean, she's kind of how I pictured her.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe a little scarier here, like a little more gaunt than I pictured her, but very similar. I mean,
yeah, definitely. They also posted an exclusive excerpt, so if you can't get your hands on the book, but you want to test it out, or, you know, you're not sure you will like it and you want to read a chapter from it, go check that out. But it's very good. You know, it comes highly recommended from us. I also wanted to mention that Sarah Boateng's Guide to Witchcraft and Mayhem releases on September 12th. We won't be doing our discussion until a couple weeks after that, because like I said, our schedule is a little bit wonky right now, so you'll have a little more time to get into that one, but we loved the first book. Very sure that I'm going to love the second book.
Yeah.
So, you know, just keep an eye on that. Comes out on the 12th. And then Chalice of the Gods comes out on September 26th, which is way closer than it has any right to be, because that's going to be a big one for us.
Yeah.
And Kristen and I had an executive meeting this morning.
We did.
And we decided we're going to change things up a little bit. And I hope that you guys like this, because I think ultimately it will serve both us and you guys a little bit better.
We think you'll be excited.
Yeah. So we decided that with Chalice of the Gods, because we want to get through it fairly quickly and because we really want to focus on what's happening in the book, we're probably going to end up doing like 2 to 3 chapters at a time, so that we can get through it a little bit faster. That will be our main discussion and our chapter. We are pausing the Red Pyramid to focus on this. So I think we're just going to do the chapters.
It's going to be all things Chalice of the Gods and the news for the foreseeable future.
Yeah.
We'll also probably stick in a book discussion here and there when the time arrives. Yeah. Like Fox Snare is supposed to come out sometime this fall, and we probably will want to cover that. So we'll, you know, do a chapter and cover that when that arrives. But like, other than that, it's basically going to be all Chalice of the Gods all the time until we get that one done.
And I think that'll be good, because that means we can get back to Red Pyramid sooner and not really forget about like what was going on in the book. It'll get us through Chalice of the Gods faster, which is good, because it's already going to be hard for you to do a chapter at a time.
I was going
to
say, doing one chapter at a time in that book, it was going to take us, what, a year to read it, probably? That was going to take too long. I was going to be crazy by the time we got there, especially trying to avoid spoilers, because as much as we, you know, I would say we try to be respectful. Most people try to be respectful, not to spoil that sort of thing. You can only avoid them for so long.
Right.
Like, people can only avoid talking about the book on social media or whatever for so long before you're really just like, okay, I need to talk about the thing.
Mm-hmm.
Which is totally fair.
And I will have read the book already for the release date, because I plan on writing a review, which means that I can help break up the book into, like, certain chapters if, oh, these first 2 chapters go really well together, or the next 3 go really well together. I can kind of, like, say that. And then we'll let you know ahead of time which chapters we're doing. And, you know, maybe it'll be one chapter and a different discussion some week. We're going to keep it really loose and just depending on what's going on and what we want to do. But that way we can move through it a little faster. I think it'll be better ultimately.
Yeah, I think it'll be more enjoyable, because it won't be like one chapter. So it's the shortest chapter ever and it's just build up to this next little thing. And we have to wait a whole week to get to the thing. And like, while that works for like Red Pyramid, because we're, you know, it's an older book, we're not worried about spoilers, we're just kind of making our way through and really looking at it deep, I think taking 2 or 3 chapters and having it be the only thing we're talking about will kind of be the same thing, but just, help us to move through the book a little quicker. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I mean, since this is a brand new book, like, I just want to get through it. I just want to talk about it with everybody.
I'm kind of jumping off things, because there is no section for this in the news and updates, but we don't really have a strike update. Things have kind of stagnated, but I just want to give major props to Taylor Swift, who gave a big middle finger to the studios this week by completely bypassing them and making her deal for her concert movie that is going to make hundreds of millions of dollars straight with the theaters.
Really?
She initially went to production companies and said, I want to make this movie. I want to make a movie of this tour. I want it to air while I'm still on tour, but while I'm doing the overseas shows so that people in America can still see the show while I'm out and about. And they said, the earliest we can give it to you is summer of 2024 after you're done with your tour. And she was like, no. And she didn't really say anything more to them, so they all thought they were still jockeying for position. She went to AMC and said, listen, I have this thing. I really want to put it out. When do you have a hole in your schedule? When can we do this? And they said, would you like to do fall 2023? And she goes, that's exactly when I wanted it to. And so then Cinemark stepped in, and then Regal has also come in now.
Okay.
So she has basically created her own production company. There is no dramatic acting in this, so she's not breaking SAG-AFTRA rules, because as far as I know, she is a member of SAG-AFTRA. Okay. Because she's appeared in enough productions like Valentine's Day and...
Oh, okay.
I think she does have her SAG card. She might not, but, like, she's not breaking... SAG-AFTRA rules either.
Yeah, I'm sure she would be very careful about
absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. Plus, yeah. She's made an agreement with SAG-AFTRA to make sure that she's compensating her people the way they would want them compensated, which could mean, we do not know this for sure, that her dancers may end up getting royalties from...
Really?
This, because they're performing in the movie, and she's right. made an agreement with SAG-AFTRA that people would be compensated correctly.
Yeah.
So we don't know for sure if that's actually the thing, but, like, just major props to Taylor Swift for handling this really, really well, for being an ally to those in SAG-AFTRA and kind of doing the whole thing herself. She hired a director, he came in, directed the whole thing, and they're putting it out all on their own.
Wow.
So, yeah, it's kind of hilarious, and the studios are pissed. They're missing out. They're missing out on hundreds of millions of dollars, and they know it. Because worldwide, it's going to make so much money.
That could be a turning point for the strikes.
It really could be. And that's why I wanted to talk about it very briefly, because losing out on an opportunity like this because they shot themselves in the foot could be the real turning point, and hopefully will get us a deal. I know right now a lot of them are talking like it could be mid-2024 before we see a deal.
I've heard that.
And that just seems so ridiculous and so over the top that I'm hoping this major loss by them will kind of stir the pot and get them back to the table.
Because,
faster.
Like, you know, not to be like, oh, what about us? You know, because we're more important. Like, if the show comes out, and this strike isn't over, we're not going to talk about it, and that is going to be devastating.
Absolutely devastating, because we started the podcast with the intention of covering the show. We really were excited to cover the show when it came out, and we wanted to, you know, really have a base of episodes behind us, and we didn't know it was going to be this long, and to not be able to cover the show when it comes out is going to break our little hearts, but we won't if the strike is still going on. We will wait and cover it when the strike is over and we have an opportunity to do so.
Yeah. We'll get there when we
get there. Hopefully, this will be a major inciting incident to get everybody back to the table and say, we can't have any more of this.
Yeah.
We need to make a deal. So we'll just leave it at that, I guess.
Yep. Guess so. Getting into our main discussion this week, we are talking about The Spirit Glass by Roshni Chokchi. This is a standalone novel based in Filipino culture and mythology and folklore and all of that kind of stuff. This is sort of the other half of Roshni's background, and I really loved it because I don't really know much about all of this, and it was really awesome to get that peek into it. So the first thing I want to say is, you know, what is this book about? So Corazon Lopez visits with the spirits of her parents every Saturday night thanks to the soul key that hangs around her neck. When a malevolent spirit steals it away, she must retrieve it before all manner of spirits find their way into the living world. So immediately from the get-go, we kind of have this idea that, okay, she's lost her parents, so that's like tough for a 12-year-old kid. And, you know, somebody stole the soul key, and not only does that have repercussions for her personally, but the world at large. And there's, from some of the articles that we've read, there's just a lot of mystery right from the beginning of this book. And so I guess the first question is, and this is our spoiler-free section, we'll start off without any spoilers, What did you think of this book? How does it compare for you to what you've read of Arusha so far?
I was going
to
say, I've only read the first Arusha book. And while I remember, like, really enjoying it, the details of everything of Arusha are kind of mixed in my head with some of the other RRP books we've read. So it's a little hard for me to make a, like, direct comparison. But I absolutely loved this book. I really loved how just smart Corazon is. Like, as much as I love Percy, he makes some dumb mistakes sometimes. And I feel like in this book, Corazon doesn't really make stupid mistakes. She really thinks through problems and tries to see problems coming before they arrive so that she can, like, make things better and not get herself into all kinds of trouble. Things happen. I mean, obviously, it's kind of a little mini adventure quest book. We, you know, it's falls right in line with a Rick Riordan book in that way. But it's not like she's constantly dealing with one thing after another that are coming at her and she's trying to respond the right way and messes up. And, like, I feel like Corazon really does a good job of, like, trying to solve problems kind of ahead of time. Mm-hmm. She's got a little more Annabeth in her, I think, than she does Percy.
Yeah, I could see that.
And so, yeah, I really, really loved this book. I loved, as I told Karen, I cried four times. Three or four times, at least. It just kind of broke me in some places because it's really intentional. There's so much really great, like, heartfelt story plotting toward the end of this book, especially. The beginning is funny and witty and cute and adorable, and you will absolutely fall in love with it, and then she will break your heart and then make it kind of whole again and then fix it and, you know, whatever. So it's a really, really lovely book and has some really great themes in it that I don't necessarily think people assume you get in middle grade kind of stories. And you absolutely do. Like, these are themes I would love to read in an adult book sometimes that you don't necessarily, you think you should see them and you don't because they're too busy focusing on the world building and this and that. And I love how centered and just direct, like, Roshni knew what she was writing here and you could just feel her getting to the heart of the story the whole way through.
I felt that way, too, because this book is only about, like, 280 pages long. And I was like, oh, that's, like, a little bit shorter than usual. But I felt like, yeah, she just, like, walked into this story and knew exactly what she needed to say with it. She didn't waste any time. And she just, like, boom, 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 got through the quest and to the end and, like, what it all meant. And I really appreciated that as somebody who struggles to read longer books. But also, the writing just moved very quickly. It was very easy to get through.
I was going to say, if Roshni, like, in an interview says, like, oh, I had no idea where it was going, I will give all the props to her editors then. Because it does not feel like she had no idea where it was going. It feels from the beginning like there is a path and here we go. And it doesn't really slow down. You're just kind of, you know, going from the next step to the next step the whole way through the book.
Yeah. I also loved it. I actually felt like it really did not feel like Arusha, which I think is a good thing. I think that it very much felt like a different kind of story. And there's always going to be similarities because these are her books. It's her mind. It's going to have something in common with each other. I felt like this really was a world apart from Arusha, and I loved that about it. And maybe it's because the last book that I read from Rosh was The Last Tale of the Flower Bride, but I thought that they shared a lot in common. This was like, not necessarily in terms of what the story was trying to say, because they are two very different books, but the way that she wrote the stories, this felt a little bit like the middle grade version of that adult book, because her prose was like a little bit more flowery, a little bit more abstract than what we saw in Arusha. Arusha is a pretty straight, like, adventure story. If you've read, you know, any Rick Riordan books, like, that's a straight adventure story, and I felt like Arusha was the same way. Whereas this one was a little loftier, and you really get a lot more of that in Last Tale of the Flower Bride. So if you've read that one, I would recommend Spirit Glass. And if you like Spirit Glass, then I would think that you would like Last Tale of the Flower Bride.
I love hearing that as a person who just bought a copy of Last Tale of the Flower Bride, because I was like, I love Roshni, and I'm really excited to see her kind of write an adult story and see what that means. You know, how does she write an adult story? Because I like her writing for middle grade stuff. So, like, I'm really intrigued. So, yeah, I'm very, very excited to read Last Tale of the Flower Bride now. Good. Because I really loved this book. Yeah. So, seeing a kind of grown-up version or, like, you know, a step more mature than this is very appealing to me.
Yeah. Good. Awesome. And you were talking about the themes and everything, and like we've been saying in a lot of our recent books, I feel like a lot of the Rick Renn Presents books that we've been reading lately have to do with grief and have to do with, like, losing a family member.
I feel like it's, A, coming out of the pandemic where so many people lost people, I think that's, it's very valuable.
Yeah, that's fair.
Because I think there's a lot of kids who are dealing with grief of one form or another. It may not even be a loved one, but maybe your family lost a lot because they lost income, and so you're living a totally different lifestyle and you're grieving what you had before, or there's all kinds of things that you can grieve. And so, yeah, I really do think a lot of kids' books these days have some sort of thread about grief. Even, like, movies, even, like, Frozen 2 had such a strong grief-centric storyline that I think is really valuable to kids to kind of help them learn how to grieve and to allow themselves to grieve and that it's healthy and you need to and all of that. So, yeah, it's not surprising, but also there has been a lot of talk about
grief. Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, though. The pandemic probably has influenced that a little bit. And also, just, it is really good to help kids move through these kind of emotions with middle grade books, because it is a fact of life that people die, and some kids have to deal with that much sooner than others. And unfortunately, Corazon lost both of her parents, and that is a very difficult thing to do. So we have themes of grief, we have themes of acceptance, which I thought was really powerful by the end of the book. Spirituality plays a large part in this, literally in terms of, like, spirits being around.
Yeah.
Magic and power and how that grows in somebody, how somebody can use that and come into that. Secrets. There's a lot of secrets in this book. Family also plays a large part, and so does food and culture. And I got the biggest Gracie Kim vibes from this.
Yeah.
I really feel like if you love the food aspect of Gracie's books, The Last Fallen Star, Moon Realm, you're going to love the food in this one, because it was very much the same.
And at the end of Spirit Glass, Roshni has kind of a note from the author section where she talks about, like, food is so important to Filipino culture that I could not leave it out of this book. So she did research and, like, got that aspect of it, like, super right, because she was like, I know how important it is. Mm-hmm. So I loved that. I thought that was really cool.
I think I've said this before, but, like, always read the author's notes. Always read acknowledgements and intros. Never skip those, because they are a wealth of information, especially if you're interested in how books come together, because she not only lists a lot of her sources at the end of the book, but she talks specifically about the people who helped her, both friends and family, and also researchers and people who are experts in this area.
I don't remember if the chef was a friend, but she actually had, like, a Filipino chef or someone who knows Filipino food very well helping her kind of make sure that things were accurate and authentic and not, you know, a cheap imitation or whatever.
Right.
So I absolutely loved seeing that she had so much help writing this book.
And sensitivity readers and all of that kind of thing. And this is a part of her background, so this is something that she's familiar with, and yet she thought it was important to go to other people who were even more of an expert than she was. And that was really important for me to see. I really liked that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, because these stories often have even loftier themes and everything, colonialism is a big part of this book, and there's a lot of history of the Philippines wrapped up in this, and Spanish colonization, and it was not information that I'm very familiar with, so I did find it very interesting. We won't really be getting into that too much, other than how it relates to one of the characters, but it was a really nice way to, like, round out the story. It wasn't just about what was going on in Corazon's life, but also, like, how the Philippines being colonized affected her life and her culture and all of that. So
I will be the first person to tell you, when I read Corazon's name, Corazon Lopez, I was a little surprised to know that it was a Filipino book, because I didn't know anything about the Spanish occupation of the Philippines and, like, all of that. So, like, it confused me a little why the name was so, like, Spanish, you know, Latin sounding.
Yeah.
And it was a book written about Filipino culture. So I honestly learned a lot in this book about what went on and how those worlds kind of ended up being combined. So,
yeah.
Very cool. It's
very, very interesting. Let's talk about the characters now, though, because there are a lot of fantastic characters in this book.
Yes.
I really liked so many of them. So, Corazon Lopez is the first one. Of course, she is turning 12, and her Babylon powers have not manifested yet. And this is kind of weird. Her mother's powers manifested much earlier than that. And usually by the time you turn 12, you start going into training, and she hasn't even had a whiff of powers yet. She can, like, maybe levitate something a few inches, but that's about it. And so she's very frustrated with the fact that she hasn't come into her abilities. Her whole world revolves around seeing her parents, who, like we talked about, died. She doesn't have any friends. She doesn't go to school. She's technically, like, homeschooled by her aunt. And yeah, she just pretty much looks forward to dinners on Saturday nights where she gets to see her parents. Althea is her mother. She is warm, kind, very powerful when she was living, loving, a little more serious than her husband. And then there's Emilio, who immediately stole my heart.
He's a menace. And
oh my God. I was just immediately smitten with him. He is hilarious. He is silly. He is so loving and full of life despite being dead. And he just always says something that, yeah, he's, you can tell he's the troublemaker in the relationship, and he's the one who kind of, you know, says things that are out of left field. And
he keeps Althea light.
Yes.
Like, I love in books and in real life, because my sister kind of married someone who keeps her light.
Yes.
My sister can be kind of serious, and she married a guy who is very goofball-esque.
Yeah.
And keeps her enjoying life and having fun. So I really love watching a character like Althea marry someone like Emilio, who together they complement each other so well. He brings her light and happiness and keeps things from being too serious, and she helps him to take things seriously when it's necessary.
Yeah.
And it's just a perfect, wonderful compliment, and I really love that.
It's so tragic that, you know, they're dead, because I would have loved to have seen even more of them throughout
Agreed.
This story. It was just, their relationship is goals.
It is. It really is. Even for dead people.
Yes. Yeah. And so Corazon is, like, you know, she's kind of a good mixture of the two of them, I would say, because she's not quite, like, she's a very curious girl, and she has a vivid imagination, and she's not quite, like, the troublemaker that Arshaw is, but at the same time, she's not afraid of breaking a couple of rules either, and she just can't help but be curious about things and love this world that she's in that she can't, like, really take part in yet.
Yeah.
And so every Babylon has an Anito, which is basically, like, a spirit animal of some sort. There are animals that are, like, nature spirits, and they come in all different forms of animals. Hers is named Sasso, and he's in the shape of a gecko who thinks he's a baby crocodile, basically, and he is hungry for violence, but also food.
Sasso is...
he was maybe my favorite part of this whole book.
I mean, just the never-ending litany. Every time he gets scared by something, he hides and then comes out either in search of food or violence.
Yes.
It's always food or violence. Either he senses that there's a need for vengeance and runs out into battle, or he smells something really good and needs to find out what it is.
Yeah.
And I love a consistent king.
Yes.
Because I'm more than happy to just have Sasso be Sasso, and those are the things important to him, and it is not changing.
Yes.
And I just, I loved everything about
that.
Yeah,
all of the quips were just so hilarious. He brought a lot of levity to the story. I loved that he was both really brave and a coward at the same time. Like, how you can manage that, I have no idea. But he did it flawlessly.
He had his moments, and
yeah.
It just worked.
And, like, every time he would be like, vengeance, and then jump off her shoulder, and she'd have to catch him and bring him back. Oh, it was so funny. And I think, like, in a way, like, she is a little more serious. And so, like, having him around to kind of, like, stir up that side of her where she's a little less serious, she's a little more interested in, like, you know, battles and stuff like that, worked really well.
I don't know if this is exactly the right description of him, like, physical description, but I could not help but picture Bruni from Frozen 2. That's exactly who I pictured. Little Bruni, but, like, if Bruni was able to talk.
Yeah.
And if Bruni had a little more blood vengeance in his eyes. Yeah. Like, Bruni in Frozen 2 is very innocent and sweet and, like, is just a little warm salamander. But if you give him a little more of a thirst for blood, I think you've got Sasso down to a science. And, yeah, because, like, Bruni just leaps off of cliffs and waits to be caught by the wind. And, you know, that is so Sasso. It was really fun to kind of have a little physical embodiment in my head. Like, okay, he could very well just kind of, yeah.
And every time he licked his eyeball, like, I kept picturing that, too.
Yeah.
It was great. And then there's Aunt Tina. This is Corazon's mother's sister. She is a very powerful Babylon, and she's cold. She doesn't like hugs. She doesn't show affection or offer kind words. She's definitely keeping secrets. That
all
is
the,
like,
secrets.
From the very, very beginning, you know that she's keeping secrets. She's very blunt. She's very matter of fact. I ended up actually kind of liking this about her because even though she was keeping secrets, she was honest about pretty much everything else. Like, she would just tell you how it is.
Yeah.
And I like that in people. She sells spells and remedies to those in need at the Midnight Bridge Market. And this was actually, like, a really beautiful scene that I loved a lot that ended up being extremely important later in the story. And we can talk about that later. And so usually when I read a book, I take notes throughout so I don't forget, like, my thoughts in the moment. And I just wrote in my notes, Tina is shady AF.
It's true, though.
And that was, like, right at the beginning. I was like, she is up to something.
As much as you can feel that, like, she's not bad, like, she doesn't feel evil or bad or anything like that, you can feel that there is something very wrong with the whole situation between her and Corazon. Mm-hmm. Like, she's clearly her, you know, her aunt, and she loves her, but, like, there's something missing there, and you just kind of feel it from the beginning that, like, there's something really off about Aunt Tina, and, you know, we need to figure that out.
Yeah.
I did love that when Corazon was sort of talking about her magic, it felt like it was, like, kind of like, you know, like Harry Potter magic, where it's like you can do spells and whatever. But I loved seeing that Tina, like, prepares, like, tinctures and potions and can, like, use herbs and whatnot to create things that help others to heal wounds or to solve problems or whatever. So I love that, like, the magic wasn't easily definable. Like, there's a lot of ways that the Babylons do magic and can use their power, and I just thought that was really cool.
Yeah, because you're right. Like, some of it's potions and stuff like that. Some of it is, like, actually saying, like, rhyming spells. Some of it is just uttering a word and putting, like, your will into it. And, yeah, it's not easily definable, but I think that makes it even more magical because it really is kind of, like, your own flavor of magic, like, how you want to do it. And the fact that Aunt Tina is so powerful and can do so many things was super interesting to me, and I loved, like, watching her work, even while we knew she was keeping secrets. And I think the thing with the secrets, too, was you weren't entirely sure if she was keeping them for selfish reasons, or if she was keeping them to protect Corazon or herself or whatever. But, like, yeah, you knew she wasn't evil. You knew that she was doing something that ultimately was kind of benefiting Corazon, but we didn't really know what that was for quite a while, actually.
Yeah.
So after we get through the Midnight Bridge Market and all of that, well, actually before that, before we go to the Midnight Bridge Market, we go to the Library of Mirrors, and we meet Librarian Bulusan, who is described as thus: wrinkled brown skin like tree bark, hair and beard like dandelion fluff, long and yellow and sharp teeth, warm eyes, always smoking a cigar, and he's like 50 feet tall. He is a Capre who is basically a tree giant, and he is in charge of the Library of Mirrors. And I really loved that he was, like, huge and scary and had those pointed yellow teeth, but his eyes were warm. You know, I love the, like, dichotomy there.
Yeah, kind of Entian.
Yes, definitely.
I mean, you can't think of a tree person and not think of an Ent.
Yeah.
If you've seen Lord of the Rings, you know exactly what I'm talking about. Or if you've read the book. Yeah. I have not read the book, but I've seen the movies and I know the Ents very well. But he has a little more of a... He's more with it. Like, the Ents are kind of old-worldy and their minds and hearts are with the old way of doing things. The Caprae definitely knows what's going on, is very with it, is very knowledgeable. I really enjoyed the librarian. I thought he was a very interesting character and has a job and a role and knows what his role is.
Yeah.
And is concerned with making sure he does his job to the best of his ability.
Yeah, I really liked that too. So, two of the spirits that play a large part in this book include Leo, a young spirit of a boy who wants to be a writer and agrees to be Cortezone's spirit guide in exchange for gaining inspiration for his book. And we know that, like, he's not decaying like the other spirits have, but we don't know why. We don't know how. And that's kind of a semi-spoilery thing, so, like, I'm going to save that for later, but... You know, we talked about Leo last week when we saw his image on Reed Riordan. He's very cute with his wire rim glasses. And I ended up, he was kind of exactly what I expected him to be, and I really liked him.
I would say remarkably different, similar to Leo Valdez. They have some characteristics I would say are kind of similar, but for the most part, they have very different in interests. I really loved Leo and getting to know the things that make him tick. And, you know, his passion for writing and his, you know, determination to get the story, like, to have it be the most adventurous and fun and, you know, have the most death and the most opportunities for death and, like, all of that. I really enjoyed him and his role in the story. He was a lot of fun.
His commentary on writers and writing, I just heard Rosh talking the entire time, and it was so funny to me. Like, you know, oh, writers are liars, and, like, you know, like, it doesn't have to be accurate as long as it's entertaining and stuff like that. And,
yeah.
That really made me laugh. And then we have Flor de Lisa de Leon, who we already kind of talked about. She is the spirit who stole Corazon's soul key so she can find her little light. And there will be more on that later.
Mm-hmm.
But for now, we are getting into the spoiler section because there is a lot of stuff to talk about.
Should we talk about the house before we enter the spoiler section?
Yes, we should.
Because it plays a little bit of a role, especially at the beginning of the book.
Yeah. Yeah, let's talk about the house because I could not stop thinking of Encanto.
Same.
Of course. Like, it was just very hard not to.
It's the easy parallel.
Yeah.
And it is kind of similar to Encanto, but I would say the house kind of goes a step further.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it cooks for them.
Yeah.
The house takes care of them all the time. Both Aunt Tina and Corazon. So, like, it, you know, if Corazon is hungry and basically says it out loud, the house will start cooking something for her and deliver it to her. And if Aunt Tina is ready to go to the market, all she has to do is basically say a couple of words and the garden starts pruning itself and the house brings them to her, you know, starts putting them in a basket. Like, I loved Encanto with the house especially. I loved the magic of the house so much that I really enjoyed the house being involved in this here. I thought it was a fun way to kind of give the beginning of the book some levity to when you're learning about Corazon and her parents and Aunt Tina kind of being stern and shady AF. It was really nice to have this very welcoming, fun, very caring house around Corazon. And you can tell that she's had a really good childhood despite having lost her parents, because the house is always there taking care of her.
Yeah, and the house ends up being, like, a lot more important than I ever expected it to be.
Agreed. It was a twist I did not see coming.
Yeah, so that was really, really awesome. And I think that, you're right, is a good point to go into our spoiler section. So if you don't want to know anything else about this book, pause now, skip ahead to the discussion of the Red Pyramid.
Last chance? Okay.
Yeah. So I want to talk about the Library of Mirrors first, because for me this felt like a crossroads for various forms of the afterlife, with the Spirit River running through it. We get a mention of many different types of mirrors and how mirrors are kind of ways that you can, like, bounce between different areas and stuff like that. This whole idea of mirrors throughout this book was, like, super interesting to me.
Yeah.
The mirrors stealing things, which is why we lose so many items, like, you know, socks and lipstick tubes and all of that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And the mirrors even have their own sections throughout the book where, like, they talk to the reader.
Yeah.
That was, like, creepy at first, and then I was like, oh, this is actually very, like, ethereal, like, very, you know, it just added another layer to the book.
Well, not knowing what role the mirrors were going to play at the beginning, I think you're a little suspect of why the mirror's talking to you directly. Like, why am I getting this, you know, little mini section of the mirror's perspective? And the mirror's talking about Corazon, kind of in a weird third-person-esque kind of way, I think.
Yeah.
I think it's third-person. Like, the mirrors are not directly talking about Corazon, but they also kind of are. Yeah. And
they mention her as, like, the girl. Like, right. It's a little bit more distant.
And then sometimes it's more flowery than that, too, and they don't directly link things to her. Yeah, it's very... I really loved the little mirror sections. I felt like they gave us a little bit of, like, direction, even when we didn't have it coming from the main story. Like, you'd get one of those between chapters every so often. So I don't remember if it was every chapter, but it was fairly often. Yeah, I really enjoyed the mirror's perspective, and by the end, it was nice to kind of think back to the mirror's perspective throughout the book and be like, oh, they really were, like, kind of, you know, the mirrors are watching all the time and kind of are present for all of this too, mm-hmm. and aren't really doing anything, not really trying to change things or anything like that, but they are present for the events of this book and have a role to play. So I thought that was cool.
Yeah, the mirrors are basically, like, omniscient, so they kind of exist all at once, all of the time, slightly outside of what's going on with Corazon. And the reason why it was creepy to me in the beginning was because it was like mirrors see everything you do. They hear everything you say. They know everything. And it's not just mirrors. It's any shiny surface. It could be a droplet of water. Anything that reflects can, like, be this window into another world. And, like, that could be the start of a horror novel.
It really
could. And mirrors play a large part in a lot of horror novels and movies and stuff because they can be super creepy.
Yep.
But I, you know, as you kind of go on, you see that they are a little more omniscient. They're, you know, not part of the story. They just kind of happen to be a witness to it. And I found that to be really, really interesting. I also wanted to point out that we get a mention of many different types of mirrors, like I was talking about, including a compact mirror from a makeup case. And I could not help but think about Minnie, because Minnie from Arusha has that, and she's the daughter of the god of death. And so I didn't know if this was, like, a direct reference, or, I mean, how could it not be, you know?
Right.
Just, like, you could have written anything in there, and you chose that. And I just feel like, even if it's not related, I feel like Rosh put it in there as a nod to Arusha, which I thought was cool.
I think so, too. I definitely think that was where it was leading.
Yeah. So pretty close to the beginning of the book, Flordelisa steals the soul key, and Tina tells Corazon she has to take the woman's necklace, which they grabbed. It has, like, a little cameo on it, and get two blessings, and then meet her in the Library of Mirrors, and she only has 5 days to do this. So we get, like, a very straightforward quest in
this
book.
Here we go. Yeah.
You got a time limit, you got a goal, you got things you got to accomplish before that time limit is up.
You're going into the unknown.
Yeah.
Here you go.
Into the unknown.
Pretty much.
So the first stop is visiting the Bakunawa, which is a serpent-like sea dragon who ate the moon because he thought it was a cookie. That was really cute.
Mm-hmm.
I got major Mushu vibes and major Tamatoa vibes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because you think it's going to be this giant dragon or sea serpent or something like that. And then it's this little thing like Mushu. But he also loves collecting things like Tamatoa. And it ended up just being like this really kind of funny, because he was like, oh, woe is me, you know, I don't have any friends anymore, the moon doesn't like me anymore, and nobody will, like, come hang out with me, he was very lonely, and his lair was super dirty, so they end up using the calamansi fruit to, which reveals the true nature of things, to clean up his lair, and he could finally see again. Everything got shiny, and the light shone around, and he grew and grew and grew until he was back to his real size, and then he went off to go talk to the moon, who used to be his friend, and the whole thing was that he was trying to bring her down to Earth, but then the people were making, like, loud noises, and it scared him, and he dropped the moon, and she got mad, and they haven't talked since. And he also, you know, before he goes and does that, he gives his blessing, so she gets her first blessing.
Yeah, I feel like it's kind of hard not to really love the Bakunawa, because he is very, like, as much as Tamatoa is kind of a bad guy, he's trouble.
A little bit, yeah.
You feel like this guy is kind of misunderstood, because yeah. Everybody fears him, and has feared him, and he's, you know, this terrible sea serpent beast that, you know, ate the moon. He ate the moon. Where when you meet him, it's like, oh, you were just trying to bring your friend to your place to, like, hang out.
Yeah.
And things didn't go as planned, and now you've been alone all this time, and you got depressed, and you didn't clean up, and your place is a disaster, and you're having a hard time digging yourself out of that hole. And I just, I couldn't help but really just feel...
AKA depression.
Right? I know. Yeah. Like, I couldn't help but feel for him, because it was just so sweet that he just needed some help digging himself out of the trouble, the pit he was in. And once he got the help he needed, he was good to go. He was, you know, ready to go meet a friend. He was ready to go, you know, make peace with the moon and enjoy his life again. And I just really loved this little section of the story so much. Yeah.
I think this part was so important for so many reasons, because Corazon was, like, really afraid of him at first when she thought he was this giant sea serpent. There was a lot of build-up to, like, finally getting to meet him. And then you realize that he's a lot smaller than she thought he would be. And then Leo and Sasu kind of encourage her to deceive him, to try to get away with, you know, doing this small minor thing, like tricking him into giving her his blessing. And she's like, I can't do that. Like, that's just not right. And she puts in the hard work to help dig himself out of this depression that he's in, basically.
And I mean, she didn't really give up anything that she wouldn't have given up. If she would have done what Leo and Sasso wanted her to do, she would have given up the calamansi fruit, would have just given it to the Bakunawa, and would have left, and it would have been deception that got her the blessing, and I don't know if it would have even worked, because it wouldn't have necessarily been a fair trade.
Mm-hmm.
But she didn't lose anything more by staying and using the calamansi fruit to clean and reveal the true nature of the cave, the lair. Like, nothing else was lost in this transaction that she wouldn't have already lost trying to deceive him, but so much more was gained because she actually got the blessing she needed because she put her heart on the line and thought through the scenario and was like, mm-hmm. It needs to be a fair trade. That's the power of, you know, the Babylon magic. That's how this works. That's how I get what I need, and I can't, tricking him is not going to get me where I need to go. And I just love that Corazon was so honest with herself and honest with Leo and Sasso, and is like, guys, that's not the way to do this. And,
yeah,
you know, even the Bakunawa was a little surprised that this was her reaction, and, like, she seemed like she was ready to hand over the fruit and then says no, and he's like, what?
Yeah.
Like, how dare you, you know, pull back at the last second, and then she offers him something so much better and something that really transforms his life. Mm-hmm. So, I really, really loved all of the meaning in Corazon's actions in this portion of the story, because it really just proved that she's not necessarily out to do the easiest thing all the time just to get by and get out of here. She wants to do what's right. And I thought that was really informative of, like, who Corazon is as a person.
Yeah. And I think that's a really interesting comparison, too, to make between Aru and Corazon, because Aru, I feel like, would try to get away with it. And, like, ultimately, she would also do the right thing because she's a good person, but she's a little bit more of a trickster than Corazon is. So it was nice, like, even in the book, Aru Shah has talked many times about, like, she does lie a lot and stuff like that. And Corazon is like, I don't like lying. So, like, they're two very different people in that regard.
Yeah.
I would actually go a step further than what you said and say the one additional thing that she gives up by doing all of this is her time.
Yeah.
Which is very important because they only have 5 days. And so she could trick him and probably get the blessing. But she decides to stick around and, you know, quote-unquote waste her time. It wasn't wasting, but spend time with him in order to do this the right way. And ultimately, everything was so much better because of that.
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah. So then Corazon uses the Mana Nangal's hair that she got from the Midnight Bridge Market to call forth the creature, so that they could fly to their next destination, the next blessing that they had to get. Now, the Mana Nangal is a creature that can sever herself in half, whereby she leaves behind her legs to fly around and sneak into your room and slurp out your entrails.
Super fun!
She was pretty scary.
Yeah.
It was a very scary visual. And also, you never quite knew, like, where she was going to go with it. But I think that Rosh did a really good job of, like, yes, it was really creepy, but this creature also had, like, digestive problems and was actually kind of, like, polite and nice. And even though she was like, I would love to eat you, but, like, you eat too much candy, so...
I loved that.
I know. So that was so funny.
And Sasso being like, yes, my diet has saved me. Bring me all the sugar. Yeah. Like, yeah, I loved that.
Yeah. So it was a really interesting balance. And I love that, because we spent a lot of time with this creature at the Midnight Bridge Market. And I was like, okay, she's going to be important.
Yeah.
And I never really expected her to come back and help in this way. I thought she would maybe be an adversary.
And that the hair could come in handy to defend them from her was kind of my impression too.
Yeah, but Rosh really turned it on its head and I thought it was so much better because of it.
Agreed.
So the second stop is visiting the Diwata, aka Nature Spirits, and we meet Orchid Maria, Palm Tree Maria, and Rolling Hill Maria, which was so funny. They were all named Maria.
I know.
And essentially, Leo helps them cook up a spring breeze, and Corazon adds the petal from the Encanto, basically an elf creature, to finish it off. And that is what ultimately, what the fair trade is to get their blessing. There was a lot more going on with this scene, a lot of discussions of like, okay, how does Leo know how to cook so well? And
because he takes to it like that.
Yeah, and he just knows what to do. And Corazon and one of the Marias meets for like a private discussion at one point, and she kind of asks her like, what's your plan here? Like, what's in your future? Do you really know what you're walking into? And it's very clear that Corazon doesn't, but ultimately, like, this is kind of what happens there, as they do get the blessing. And so afterwards, they have to cross the Bridge of Clouds before they can use the Agimat, which is the pendant that Aunt Tina gives her to take her to the Library of Mirrors.
Question.
Yeah.
Do you think the Marias set her up to be attacked by the things
on the bridge?
Because they disappeared immediately upon leaving their area.
Yeah.
Like, they couldn't go back to him, basically. Corazon looks behind her, and the Marias and their whole setup is gone. I kind of wondered if they didn't say, like, if this child is strong enough to withstand whatever happens on the bridge, so be it. But they didn't really give her a great heads up about what she was coming up against. Like, they had to have known what was awaiting her on the Bridge of Clouds, but they didn't give her any real warning about what was coming. And I feel like if they were completely benevolent, they would have said, like, there are dangers on the Bridge of Clouds. You know, you need to have your wits about you. You need to do this, you know. They didn't really do that. So I kind of a little bit felt like they were giving Corazon, like, a push and saying, if you're strong enough to withstand this, you will. If you don't, you'll have fed them and I won't have to deal with them for a minute. You know, I don't know. I just felt like there was something dishonest about the Maria sending her off without giving her any idea of what was coming.
So I have two immediate thoughts to that. One, are those mouths, which is what attacks them, are they always on the Bridge of Clouds or are they just like a creature wandering by?
Well, that I assumed they were kind of always there, but maybe they are just a creature wandering by.
Yeah, because that would change the interpretation of that whole thing. And the second thing is, I kind of like the idea that they did it on purpose, but not for any nefarious reason, because it's only when she dropped the Agimat and had to rely on her dress that she started putting together the pieces of, like, who she really is and who her parents are and Tina and all of that. So, like, it did seem to me like the Marias knew more about them than they were willing to tell Corazon and Leo. And so I wonder if they were like, okay, you have to go through this hardship. Like, you have to drop the necklace in order to lean into what your dress can do in order to kind of realize what all is going on here. That it was like, they didn't want her to get hurt or anything, but they knew that this was sort of the sequence of events that would help her the most.
Yeah, I mean, that's fair. There was just something about how that whole transition from the Marias to the bridge and them telling her that she had to go to the bridge to use the Agimat because they, you know, their realm was protected from magic because of, you know, who they are and all, everything they're doing. And, like, it all made sense, but yeah, there's just something that kind of bothered me a little bit about them just sending her off and her immediately coming against something that was, like, an overwhelming force all at once. Yeah. So. But yeah, I think that's fair. That, like, they knew enough and they just decided, you know, this will be a good challenge for her and hopefully it'll lead her where she needs to go.
Yeah, yeah. And the other thing about the Bridge of Clouds is that Leo gets mad at the idea of being left behind all alone. And this is something that he hasn't really, like, talked about previously, but we can kind of understand why he feels this way. And she basically promises to bring him back to life along with her parents. And then
once she's Babylon, like, once she has her power.
Right, exactly. And then her dress basically starts billowing, and she figures out that she can fly to the Hall of Mirrors for the final confrontation. So we get into that now. And basically, I'm condensing a lot of this.
Yes.
because it just makes sense to talk about it now. But
it kind of unfolds a little piece at a time. Yeah. But yeah.
Because we get Flordelisa's memories throughout the book. Like, every time she gets a blessing, she gets, like, a new piece of the puzzle. And essentially, when all the puzzle pieces come together, we learn that Flordelisa was a sugar heiress to one of the largest hacienda on Panay, and she married Aurelio, who wanted to help the workers gain more independence, power, and money for their labor. So it was very much like a servitude, like indentured servitude kind of situation. And he was fighting for them to get, like, portions of their own work and to get better wages and better conditions and everything like that.
To be more self-determined, too, to, like, make their own choices and own their own land and work their own land and not necessarily be, you know, indentured to this powerful entity, you know, whatever, right. Whoever was in charge of that.
Yeah. Thing. And so Padre Francisco, who was not a good person at all, and super creepy, by the way.
Yeah.
And various wealthy people didn't like what Aurelio was doing, so they burned down Flordelisa's house, killing her husband and her son inside.
Both named Aurelio.
Yes. Yes. And that's essentially when we find out that Leo is her son. And that's who he's been waiting for. That's why he traded all of his memories so that he could stay whole so that she would be able to recognize him when she finally came through, when she finally died.
I have to say, I thought Leo was the husband Aurelio.
Oh, okay.
For a while, because the Leo and the Aurelio was too close for me for it to be a coincidence. So I was like, okay, he's definitely Aurelio. Like, that's got to be what it is. And I couldn't quite put together why he was maintaining his young appearance with that. I was like, if he's, you know, if he's waiting for his love, why is he appearing so young when in the story he's a grown man? So, like, that didn't quite make sense to me, but I figured maybe we'd find out later down the line. It wasn't until we got the second memory where Fleur de Lis really shows us what happened in the burning of the house and, like, how she found her husband and child and that they were both dead when she got there. That was when I realized it was the child, not the husband. Mm. And so then it became even more tragic because I'm like, that poor, like, the, you know, the kid obviously did absolutely nothing right. to deserve the what came of, I mean, Aurelio didn't either. He was fighting for good things, but
yeah.
like the child was a complete innocent in this scenario and they had no qualms about killing her child as well to punish her. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it just broke my heart that it was her child that's been waiting for her all this time and yeah. she's been lost to, you know, her own anger and frustration and all of that. So right. yeah, broke me a little.
So that's why you cried so much, because I didn't put this together nearly yeah. as fast as you did. Yeah. So
I think this wasn't the first place I cried, but this is where my heart kind of broke, I yeah. think, for the first time.
It was really difficult, especially because for me, I was like, okay, Fleur de Lis is obviously like an antagonist in this story right now. And then you start learning about her background, and I kind of expected at the very beginning for her to be like a little haughty, a little bit like, not like a bad person, but just not caring as much. And then it turns out that like she's as much an innocent as anybody else, and like her husband just wants the right thing to be done. And so it kind of turns that on its head, and to me that was really interesting.
It's kind of an interesting parallel also to like the Salem witch trials thing, mm-hmm. because they turned her into the bad guy, even though she literally did nothing.
Yeah.
And they turned her into this force that everyone could unite against, very much like they did with the Salem witch trials. And right. it's just, I thought that was kind of an easy parallel that my brain made in that moment. Like, oh, okay, that's kind of how, where the story is going, you know, and yeah.
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 But luckily, it ends on a happy note, and the two of them are reunited, and they are able to go to the Beyond, where Aurelio Sr. is waiting for them. And it ends happily, really, for them.
Corazon, standing at the mirror of the Beyond with Leo, and them not being able to really say anything to each other, because once Leo kind of figured out what was next, and once Corazon figured it out, they didn't say a word. It was just, you know, everybody else was talking around them and they talked to other people, but they didn't say anything to each other. And then they're standing at the mirror, and I think Corazon says something like, you know, what do you think is next? Or something like that to kind of break the tension. And that is when I started bawling for the first time. Because, like, Corazon has just made her first friend, and her friend was worried that she was gonna abandon him, and she's made the decision that, no, you're as important to me as my parents. I'm bringing you back too. I want you to be my friend. And moments later, it feels like, he's ripped away from her, and she has to grieve losing her first friend because it's what's best for him. He is going to be happiest with his mother and his father, we see, in the Beyond, and moving from this life and afterlife of kind of torment, not having any memories because he gave them up so that he could stay young enough to be recognizable to his mother. He's going to be so much happier in the Beyond, and both of them know that, but like, just the idea of someone so young at 12 years old having lost her parents has to willingly allow her only friend in the world
yeah.
to leave and to be happy, it just broke my heart. Yeah. And that was the first time I just started bawling.
Yeah. That was, the grief and the acceptance of it was really difficult because it is so tragic and yet so hopeful and wonderful at the same time. And as you were talking about that, I remembered I highlighted a bunch of things in this book. And I'm going to go through some of these quotes because they're so great. But the one in that section is, the beyond is a guarantee, you know. Life, though, that's the real wilderness. And I was like, damn.
Yeah. No, it really is. Yeah. Leo is a very wise soul.
He is. And I, yeah, that was... It's so true, and I think that kind of gives you some peace thinking about death and that sort of thing, because it is supposed to be something that is peaceful, and life is the hard part sometimes. But after this happens, we find out that Tina is injured, and basically not all is right with the world, and hasn't been for a while. So we kind of get into our final reveals here, and the big thing... that really did take me by surprise. I did not guess this at all. Was that Tina is actually Corazon's grandmother.
I didn't... Okay. I will admit to having seen the link to the story that she tells throughout this. The like, fairy tale kind of thing about the star... Sky Maiden? Yeah, the Sky Maiden. I made the parallel with the dress.
Yeah.
Very early on in the story, I was like, that dress... is related to the Sky Maidens. Like, it just is. So when her dress started flying, I was like, yes, I got that. I knew I was right. Like, yeah. But I definitely did not see Aunt Tina actually being her grandmother.
Yeah.
Coming, not from a mile away. So, yeah. Like, I knew that somehow the Sky Maiden story was involved. I thought her mother was the Sky Maiden.
So did I.
And that Aunt Tina was somehow, like, a mortal sister to her or something.
Or
like,
just one of the other Sky Maidens.
Well, I didn't necessarily think that because then there would have been two dresses and we never saw the other dress. So I was like, yeah. I don't know. But I thought somehow they were related and just Aunt Tina had a visceral reaction to Althea's choices, but, like, not the way it ended up unfolding.
Yeah. So Tina is Corazon's grandmother, Althea's mother. She is the Sky Maiden who fell in love with a human and stayed behind on Earth. Her husband died, and she was so sad she told Althea never to fall in love so that she didn't have to experience that same kind of pain.
Not with a mortal.
Right, not with a mortal, yeah, because they'll die. And, yeah. And Althea did fall in love, and she left her mother behind, and Tina buried her heart in the house so that she wouldn't have to feel, aka the house taking care of Corazon was really Tina taking care of her. That was heavy. That I was like, at first, I kind of guessed this in a roundabout way, because I was like, there's just something about... like this parallel between her being so cold and the house being so warm that makes me feel like maybe this is just part of Tina's magic where like she can't stand to be the one to do it, but like she's still taking care of her. But the fact that this is her heart and that she took her heart out of her chest and the house came alive because of it, like, hit so much harder than the alternative.
At one point I believed that like she couldn't be present when Corazon's parents were there, because if she saw them, the magic would be broken.
Oh.
Like, I thought there was a reason that she was always absent was because she wanted Corazon to have those moments. And I still kind of think it is, because by the end we learn, like, what has allowed her parents to come to her all this time. And I still kind of think that, like, if Tina had been present when they were there, there's a possibility that things may have come to ahead sooner, and Tina didn't want to take away the only thing that Corazon had that linked her to her parents.
Yeah.
And like, I think in a roundabout way it was a little bit related, but, like, not the way I thought.
And also just really difficult for Tina to see her child.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah. Especially a child she didn't agree with the choice she made, and, yeah.
Yeah.
And they were fighting, and then she died, and, yeah.
Yeah. And, but yeah, like you were talking about, we basically learn that during the car crash, Corazon is actually the one who forged the soul key with her power and wasn't able to let her parents go. And the spirit world has sort of been out of balance ever since.
I loved learning that she literally wedged the door between the spirit world and the real world open with her magic. And that's why it always felt stuck. Because throughout the book, she describes her magic like it's she's pulling on it, but it's never relenting. It won't let her use it to its full extent. And that's because the majority of her magic was being used to keep that door open.
And she couldn't let go.
She had to make the decision to let her parents go in order to retrieve the magic from the door. Such a visual, like, it gives you a really clear impression of exactly what's going on. Like, that visual of a door being wedged open, like, you can just feel exactly what happened in the crash and the moments after, and Cora's, like, the parallel between Fleur de Lisa losing control of her power and, like, burning the house completely, and Corazon kind of losing control and shoving her magic in the door to keep it open. Like, they have so much in common, and it just, as this part of the story unfolded, it was kind of like all these things hitting you at once.
Yeah, and especially, like, every time she walked by the mirror to the beyond, it kind of pulled at her, and I was like, ooh, there's something spooky going on there.
Yeah.
And so we kind of do realize, like you said, she was keeping that door open, and so she basically must give up her dreams to bring her parents back to life. She must give up her parents in order to come into her full power and to train and live her life. And I mean, this is very obviously a story about grief and acceptance and letting go and moving on, but in a very visceral, like, tangible way. But I thought it was really well done.
Yeah, and they directly talk in the book a lot about pain and how pain is not always, like, a bad thing. Like, sometimes you have to feel the pain and let it, not physical pain necessarily, but, like, you have to feel the pain and let it, like, be a part of you in order to grow, in order to be a better person, in order to, you know, move on in the world. And so it's all related to grief, really, but, like, that description that, like, pain is transformative. It, you know, we go our entire lives avoiding it at all costs, physical or non, all the time. And sometimes it's what's necessary to be a more whole person. Sometimes you have to go through the crucible to learn more about yourself to become the person you can be. And, like, that's clearly a through line in this story. Yeah. And, yeah, it was broke my heart, and I cried about 3 times at the end here. Every time she said goodbye to somebody, every time, you know, we learned, I think, pretty sure I cried when we found out about Tina's heart going into the ground and the house coming to life and the house caring for her the whole time. Like, I just started bawling.
Yeah. Yeah, and all of that is the therapy talking, like, sitting in your feelings and not ignoring them, as painful as it is, like, feeling them and then moving beyond them. That is what therapy teaches you, and it is very difficult, but also very, very beneficial. Official.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. The last little bit of this story is that Sasso is now a real crocodile, even though now he thinks he's a gecko, and he's inexplicably turned vegetarian too. Like,
Sasso, why are you so contrarian all the time?
He just needs something to fight against.
He does. He needs to be rebelling against something. When you're a little lizard, it's, I'm bigger than you think. Like, you don't know. And now that he's a crocodile, he's a lizard. He's a gecko. A gecko at heart for life. What are you talking about? And, yeah, I love that in those last, the last moments, like, Corazon is physically trying to move him around the house because he perches on her shoulder and digs his talons in, and she's like, okay, this is not gonna work.
Yeah.
Like, we gotta find other ways to, like, get you. Yeah, it's just so funny. I love Sasso.
I wanna rewrite an article about Sasso so I can see what he looks like.
I think that would be perfect. Plus, it's not really spoilery because Sasso and Sasso's growth in this book doesn't really it spoiled much of the story at all. So, like, they could totally do a Sasso article.
Yeah, definitely. So, I just want to pull out some quotes that I thought were either, like, really beautiful, and then, Kristen, I'll let you do some, too. Just because the writing in this book was so amazing.
I'm curious if we did maybe highlight some of the same things.
We probably did. So, the first one, some of these are, like, the writer in me was just, like, you know, Rosh was speaking to me directly. Like, this one, sometimes the most painful thing in the world is not a nightmare, but only half a dream. Mm-hmm. Ooh, that's a good one.
That is really good.
Yeah.
I didn't do them.
This one's from Emilio. Love is not just about what someone looks like, though, okay, Corazon? Said Emilio. Inner beauty is great, too. Inner beauty never wrinkles. Also, if anyone ever spies on you, that's actually very creepy. And Emilio, you're ruining the story. He adjusted his glasses, looking affronted. I'm adding contextual shadings with a modern lens, and he looked at Althea. Yes, fine, I'll be quiet. That was so funny.
He is delightful.
Yeah. This one's from Sasso. Corazon, when we conquer the realms and build our palace from the bones of our enemies, I would like to have glowing beetles on the walls because they would be both dessert and decor. That is the dream.
Love it.
Where Tina and Corazon were headed on the Midnight Bridge, ghosts were a common sight. A pair of them even ran a sorbetes cart with flavors like unexpected candy in your pocket and the last piece of leche flan before your sibling could eat it. Gracie Kim vibes.
Oh, yeah.
100%.
So very much.
I loved that. There were hundreds, maybe thousands of mirrors. Wall mirrors with curling gilded frames, compact mirrors from makeup cases, rearview mirrors from cars, tarnished silver plates, the polished rounded surfaces of soup spoons, and the shining glass walls of an office building. Oh yes, snacks first, revolution to follow, said Sasso happily. Today could be the day your powers wake up, Corazon, and then Tina will start training you, and you'll become the most powerful Babylon in the known realms, and then there will be plenty of targets on our backs, said Sasso. We'll have to sleep with sharp things. We'll be corrupted and with paranoia because of our greatness. We will retreat from the world in cold bitterness. Corazon blinked. Let's start with a brownie, okay?
I got that one, too.
Yeah. Ominous warning, said Sasso, clapping with delight. Dramatic exits. Conveniently cryptic responses from adults who should be taking better care of us. This is really starting to feel like an adventure. I can't tell if I'm happy or scared, or if it's acid reflux.
Yeah, that one too. Got that one too. Because all of mine, I think, are either Sasso or Leo.
Yeah. Those, and then the last one was the Beyond is a Guarantee, Real Life is the Wilderness.
So I only have four others that I highlighted that you didn't use. Mine are, again, all from Sasso or Leo, I'm pretty sure. The first one is, we just have to be patient. Excellent notion, said Sasso happily. You'll be patient and I will be obsessive. How is that helpful? I don't know, but it's certainly inevitable.
Yeah, that was a good one.
And then there's, what, asked Leo. I'm a writer. We're the most honest people around, which I loved. I also had, yep, we're representing the spirit realm's herald, said Leo, popping on his glasses. I'm Leo, the ghostwriter, and this is my assistant, colleague, Corazon interjected. Corazon Lopez, said Leo smoothly. I find the erasure of my presence extremely insulting, said Sasso. And her emotional support frog, said Leo.
Yeah. I love that he called himself a ghostwriter. That really made me laugh.
I did too. And then the last one is the crocodile, said Sasso. I am an emotional support crocodile. Can you tell? I was fully taken in by Sasso. And Leo, too, but Sasso has all the best lines, I think.
Really
all
great.
The funny ones. But I think as I get pulled into a book, I always forget to highlight things. So there's always a bunch of, like, really poignant, beautiful things at the end of books that I forget to highlight, which is why annotating, I always give credit to all the people in the world who are great at annotating and, like, really marking those things for me because I am terrible at it. So I always love the most frequent or most highlighted popular highlights on the Kindle because I can look and see what everybody else has highlighted. And I'm like, oh yeah, I loved that line too. And I can highlight it really quick and have it in my highlights as well.
Yeah, that's something that I've really gotten in the habit of doing lately, especially with these books because they speak to me and I really want to talk about certain things and like remember certain things for the podcast. So that's kind of got me into the habit of doing it more. And it's so much easier with the Kindle to just be able to highlight stuff and then doesn't mark up your book if you don't like that or anything like that. It's just so easy. So
yeah, agreed.
Yeah. I just want to round out this discussion of the spirit class by saying that, you know, like we were talking about, the ending is very much the acceptance stage of grief. And even though it's so sad that she had to give up her parents, she's also forging a new relationship with her grandmother, coming into her powers and learning to look forward instead of back. My question is, this is very much being pitched as a standalone novel, and a lot of the other Rick Riordan Presents books have been pitched that way as well and have gotten sequels. So I think I already know the answer to, would you read a sequel?
I would, I don't necessarily think this needs one.
Me neither.
I am perfectly content with where this story ended.
Yeah.
If Roshni decided there was another chapter to Corazon's story and that Grandma Tina has, you know, more to teach, or if there's a short story or a novella she wants to share with us at some point, I would 100% read it because I really love the world and this character she's given us. Mm-hmm. But
that's why she never wanted to be called Aunt Tina. Just Tina.
Yeah. She's not Aunt Tina. She's Grandmother
Tina. And Celestina, like Celestial, like it was all there.
It was all there the whole time. Yeah. But yeah, I would read it. I would absolutely read any other books that existed in this world. But I don't think it needs it. You know, where some of the other books, when we were done with them, it was like, oh, like we could read more. Like there's more in this. There's more stories to tell. And here, I am 100% satisfied with where the story ended, and if this is all this ever is, it's perfect. And
I would almost like to revisit this world with another character and have Corazon be, like, a background character, or, like, a bridge to that next character's story.
Like, maybe Corazon and Tina going to the market together because they're both working as Babylons, and, like, maybe there's someone who comes to them for help. And it's their story, so, like, we see the we're in the person's eyes who comes to them for help, so we get to see them helping.
We get an update on, like, Tina and Corazon's relationship, but we get to move into another direction.
Yeah, like, I could...
Because this world is so rich. Well, there's so much more.
Especially the Midnight Market.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like you could do a whole series of standalones in the Midnight Market that are, like, linked standalones, kind of like romance does sometimes, where you can read each book, you know, separately, and you're fine, but it's a more richer experience when you've read them all. And, like, yeah, you could do a completely different story with someone else at the Midnight Market who knows Corazon and Tina and, like, sees them around and still does their own thing. Like, I would 100% read more books in that, like, realm. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Hopefully you guys enjoyed the Spirit Glass, and if you did, let us know. Please reach out to us. We would love to talk about it some more. But now, we're getting back into the Kane Chronicles this week.
Yes, we are, with chapter 21, entitled Aunt Kitty to the Rescue. Lots of aunts this week. Tina and Kitty. So, our recap, the minion that Set sent after them is the Set animal. It's basically the perfect hunter. So, Bast plays the decoy, and Carter and Sadie make a run for the airport, once again, as birds. Okay, so yeah, when we last left, we were at the Washington Monument. They were in the, like, very top of it, and Carter was looking out the window and saw one of Set's minions had arrived. And we learn now that it's the Set animal. Carter describes this creature who does not have a name. It is the Set animal, does not have a title, because you wouldn't want to say the name if you knew it. It's that powerful and that scary.
Yeah.
It is described as big as a horse, with legs just as long, a naturally lean, muscled body, shiny reddish-gray fur, looks almost like a huge greyhound, but the tail is reptilian, forked at the end, with triangular points kind of like squid tentacles. The head has ears stuck straight up like rabbit ears, but they're shaped like ice cream cones, curled inward, wider on the top than the bottom. I tell you, I still can't picture this creature wholly. Like, you can see the tail, you can see the, like, greyhound, large horse, kind of slim-bodied creature, but there's just something about the whole description all in one that is almost impossible to really put together.
Mm-hmm.
We learned that the ears can rotate almost 360 degrees, meaning this creature can hear anything and is, like, the perfect tracker. Has a long snout, kind of curved like an anteater, but it has razor-sharp teeth and glowing eyes, which we learned the glowing eyes actually mean something.
Yeah. This was so interesting to me because we learned that Set is often depicted as this, like, composite creature that Egyptologists don't really know what to call, that it's like something other. It's like kind of dog-like, but like not exactly a dog. And this is such an interesting depiction of a creature that is often like that. Like, it kind of reminded me a little bit of the chimera and the way that that's described sometimes, but just like the different aspects of it that, you know, shouldn't really go together but do and make this terrifying creature. It's definitely scary.
Yeah.
Like, oh,
yeah.
Rick did a really good job making this thing scary.
Yeah. No, for sure. Absolutely terrified. And I'm glad it doesn't have a name because I don't want anything to Google. I don't want to look. The description is hard enough to, like, picture, but you can see all the different, like, pieces of it, and you're like, if I put all of those together, that would be an absolutely terrifying thing. So, yeah. Carter kind of realizes, thanks to Sadie, that he's able to see this creature clearly, even from 500 feet above it, and he's kind of questioning, like, how is that a thing? And Bast explains to him that he still has the sight of the falcon. And it just was something that I wanted to kind of take note of, because is this, like, our first sign that Carter is not necessarily fully in control all the time? Like, if the falcon sight is still lingering, is it because Horace and the Falcon are kind of merging with Carter? Not necessarily that Carter's not in control, because I think he is, but, like, I'm curious if these powers are something that he's going to be able to access all the time now that they've kind of awoken.
Right.
Or is it, like, a sign that Horace is gaining some control of Carter at the same time?
It's interesting that Carter's abilities are more physical than Sadie's, because he has, like, that extra strength. Now he has, like, the falcon sight. He kind of turns into and out of the bird a little bit easier, whereas she is more, like, the magical side of it, like the spells and stuff. So
yeah,
I wonder if that could also be the reason, is that this is just more within his wheelhouse.
You're absolutely right. Yeah, they do kind of have two sides of the magic coin, where certain things are easier for either one.
Yeah.
So we also learned that the glowing eyes mean the creature has caught a scent and is on the hunt. So the glowing eyes mean that it's hunting at least one of the three of them up in the tower. I loved that when Carter and Sadie look away from the window and look back at Bast, Bast's hair is sticking straight up like a cartoon cat being electrocuted, like perfectly straight up, and it just gave me a visual.
Yeah, I really liked that.
I was like, oh my gosh, that is hilarious. If the set animal has a scent, there is no escaping it. It will pursue you until it catches you. It reminds me of those Jurassic Park or Jurassic World dinosaurs in, like, the second movie where they have like, once their target is set for them, they will not stop until that is dead or they are.
Yeah.
And it kind of gave me that same feel. We already talked about the creature has no name. It is Set's symbolic creature, and it shares his cunning, strength, and evil nature. Now, Bast is the one telling us this, so I think it's important to keep in mind that Bast sees Set as evil. We have heard from Nut in the last chapter that maybe evil isn't the right... just air quoted at myself. that maybe evil isn't the best word to describe Set, because he's not necessarily evil, but in this instance, he is the opposition.
Yeah. I took note of that, too. I was like, interesting.
Yeah.
You know, I wonder if this creature really isn't, you know, that bad. But, I mean, obviously, if he's hunting on, like, that's still not good.
It's still a problem.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
Big problem.
Bast breaks the window at the top of the monument, and it gives Carter and Sadie a way to escape, but they have to fly. They have to change into birds again, which Sadie is insanely hesitant to do, which I can't blame her.
Yeah.
She had a lot of trouble transforming back from the kite before. I wouldn't want to do it again, not so fast, and not before you have a solution for how to get out of it. I 100% understand why she's like, no. Carter basically talks Sadie into it by promising her that he will stay with her, make sure she can turn back, he will help her through it, it's going to be okay, and she agrees because they really don't have another option, and I think she even sees that, like, I'm going to have to do it again, and, it, you know, whatever happens, we'll figure it out. Bast is going to jump out the window, and she does, jump out the window and distract the set animal so that they can escape, and when Bast does, she, like, it's like 500 feet, and she jumps out the window and lands gracefully as all. Like, she spreads herself out to kind of, like, cushion her fall, and then takes off at, like, 60 miles an hour and just leads the set animal on a merry chase so that our heroes can escape. Carter and Sadie do their part. They fly out of the monument toward the airport. They do stray from course a couple of times because their bird instincts have them wanting to hunt, which I thought was hilarious, and Horace actually interrupts Carter's thoughts to let him know that, like, it's going to take more and more willpower to, like, keep your human mind in your bird form, because the more time you spend as a bird, you're going to think more like a bird. Mm-hmm. Like, you just have to remind yourself that you're in charge. And yeah. I thought that was important.
This is a really interesting balance because it keeps them from turning into birds too often, which could be a really easy way to escape, to travel, to do a lot of different things. But, like, there are consequences to turning into a bird so often. So I kind of liked that about this.
Yeah, it does. It keeps it... It's not too convenient. Like, they can't use it
right
every minute of every day and just be yeah. a bird all the time and escape. Like, they're going to have to spend time in their human forms. Yeah. So they land on a parking garage roof at the airport, and Carter just assumes this will be a good place to turn back into human. Carter finds it remarkably harder to do it this time than the first time, but he's able to locate a memory of his dad's face and think about how much he misses him and how, you know, he needs to find him and kind of compel himself to be human again. And voila, he is able to take back his human form, and it's not really too long that it takes him. But he sees that Sadie is still definitely stuck in her kite form. Carter is really calm and tries to help her, and she's having a lot of trouble not panicking, and, like, she starts to kind of fly off, and he's like, no, you have to stay here so I can help you. And then he takes on that, like, tone that animal owners use with their pets, where they get very calm and just
yeah.
try to use the tone of their voice to calm. So he regales Sadie with all kinds of memories of his time with his dad, including some very embarrassing things that he's never told anyone, but who would he tell? So he's telling Sadie. And I loved that he's 100% standing by his word, that he's not just going to let her try and figure it on her own. Like, he's doing everything he can to help her through this.
Yeah. And I really want to see the other side of this when we get to Sadie's chapter, because that's going to mean something to her. Like, the embarrassing stories, she's probably going to rib him about it at some point.
Absolutely.
But, like, I think that's going to, you know, he's being vulnerable first, and I think she'll be able to be vulnerable later on. And their relationship is very slowly growing closer now that they're spending more time together. And that's, like, one of my favorite parts of this book so far, is I really want to see the culmination of that by the end. And this is just another moment that is going to be, like, pivotal to making sure that happens.
Agreed. Yeah, yeah. Carter assures Sadie that she's going to be fine and she will be able to turn back, but until they figure it out, he's going to carry her. So he arranges their baggage and so that she can perch on his arm, and they enter the airport with Sadie still in kite form on his arm. And as they're, like, walking into the building, a police officer notices this, obviously thinks it's odd, and we've talked before about Carter and his relationship to the police and how he feels like he's always kind of marked by them
yeah.
because of his appearance, because of his skin. And so this isn't surprising, but it does add a little tension to this whole moment as Carter is trying to figure out how to basically lose the police officer. And he reminds us that since he was 11 years old, the police have always kind of stopped seeing him as innocent and started seeing him as, you know, a suspect, someone who might be up to trouble, and they have to check it out. So, of course, the police officer follows them, and Carter tries to explain, and he goes to show their tickets, but he realizes that Bast has them.
Mm.
And you can tell he's just on the verge of, like, really worrying and really panicking when Bast arrives and saves the day.
Yeah.
Dressed as, like, their aunt.
Yes.
I picture, like, 80s aunt garb from, like...
Like, in a pantsuit and, yeah.
Yeah, or, like, one of those pleaty skirts with, like, the big glasses and curly weird hair. Like, she's just the epitome of, like, calm and authoritative. Like,
yeah.
She's your aunt who you go to all the time, who takes care of you. I just loved it. It was so perfect that she arrived at the exact right moment, in human form, obviously. Bast explains to the cop that Carter is going to a falconry competition, and she shows the cop the tickets she has for all of them to fly, and she shows him paperwork that allows the kite to accompany them in first class, not in a cage, which is interesting, but he buys it. Because, you know, mortals are easily manipulated by gods. So that's, you know, that's working in their favor. In this moment, Carter refers to Bast as Aunt Kitty, which I loved. And
that was
funny. And it goes back to the chapter title, so I had to include it here. But yeah, that was a really funny little bit. They escape the police. He's kind of mollified by Bast's work, and Bast tells him they have just a few minutes to get on the plane before the set animal is on them again. And Carter is still juggling both Sadie as the kite as well as, like, the box of their father's belongings and, like, things they've been carrying. And Bast shows Carter how to store this box in the duat where it will be instantly recallable anytime he needs it, but he doesn't have to physically carry it, which I think is fascinating.
Yeah.
So... there's a lot we don't know about what you can use the duat for, and I love that we get a small little bit of how magicians use the duat on an everyday basis. Carter imagines a school locker, gives it a combination that's important to him, the Lakers jersey numbers, I believe, and then locks the box away in the locker, and before he knows it, it vanishes, and he asks Bast, like, am I gonna be able to get that back? And she's like, I don't know, and then they have to go.
Yeah. This kind of goes back to the very beginning of the book, too, when he was like, if you find that locker full of stuff, then it's meant for you.
Oh my gosh, I completely forgot about that! Oh my gosh!
Yeah.
You are absolutely right. I completely blanked.
I really loved this, and this is something that I remember, I want to say, from the short stories as well, the crossover short stories. This kind of plays a part, too. But yeah, the idea that you can store something and then retrieve it from the duat is just like, yeah, you're right. It's so cool. Wouldn't it be awesome to just stick your hand out and, like, be able to grab whatever possessions you want? You'd never have to carry a book bag again or anything like that.
No more baggage fees on airports. Yeah. Airlines. Like, you could just be like, okay.
You wouldn't even need to take a plane for that matter.
Right? Like, you can just pack. Well, if you decide to. You pack your bag and you put it in the duat and then you jump on the plane and you fly to your destination and then you open the duat and take your bag out. Heck, you can wait till you're at the hotel and just put it, you know, grab it then.
Yeah.
It would be so convenient and awesome. But yeah, that's the end of the chapter. There's definitely some stuff that happens here, you know, some important information and whatnot, but I think this chapter really just gave us some really good Carter-Sadie moments where they're really just taking care of each other, and you watch Carter really just make sure Sadie knows that he's here for her, and, you know, it's going to be okay, it's all going to be fine, we just have to keep moving. Yeah. So we don't have time for you to spend forever trying to become not a kite.
It was a good combination of character moments between the two of them, but also, like, some action moments that, you know, didn't move the plot forward, but moved them closer to getting the plot moved forward. So it was, like, a really well-balanced chapter.
Agreed. Yep. Okay, so we've still got our favorite quotes and our favorite moments. Mine was actually from Bast's explanation of what was going on with them at the end, and Bast says, "It's a black kite, actually, but yes, it's a very temperamental bird. A prize winner, you know. Give it a coach seat and try to offer it pretzels, and I won't be held responsible for the consequences. No, we always fly first class, don't we, Carter?" And I also had to include Carter's response, which is, yeah, Aunt Kitty. And I it's so funny and cute, and I love them. So, yeah, that was mine. Karen, what was yours?
I couldn't really pick between these two. I mean, I loved your quote, but both of mine were also from Carter when he says, "Never bet against a cat," which I thought was funny. And also when he's talking to Horace and he says, "Not today, birdhead."
I do love him and Horace. Like, yeah. I think that's going to be an interesting relationship.
Yeah, there. For sure.
And then our favorite moments, mine was Carter trying to calm Sadie down by telling her memories. I just love that he included the embarrassing ones that he knows she's going to rib him about. And honestly, it'll probably be the thing that gets her through it, because she'll have learned something and be able to use it against him, and it'll give her great joy later.
Yeah.
What was yours?
Mine was Carter being excited to store his stuff in the duat, not only because that's cool, but also because it was in the form of a locker, because he'd never had one. That made me weirdly emotional.
It's really cute.
It is.
Like, I remember being an elementary school student, like, looking at the lockers and being like, I really wish I had a locker. Like, we had to put our stuff in our desks because we were, you know, we each had a desk. I was in a one classroom per class kind of school, which I know is kind of weird. But, like, yeah, we each had a desk. Our stuff stayed in our desk. So I didn't know anything about lockers until I got to high school. And it was, like, fascinating to have a locker. I was so excited. So I totally get Carter's enthusiasm.
Yeah.
Prophecy Radio is produced by Subjectify Media. Follow our website on Twitter, Facebook, Tumblr, and Instagram at Subjectify Media, or visit us at SubjectifyMedia.com. We are home to three other podcasts as well. Tune in to Rewatchable for in-depth discussions of your favorite canceled and cult classic TV shows, such as Firefly, Veronica Mars, Avatar The Last Airbender, Buffy, Angel, and more. Not About the Weather is a general interest show that sometimes features interviews with our favorite creators. And Not Another Teen Wolf podcast features interviews with the cast and creators and has discussed every episode of the show, as well as the movie, and Jeff Davis's new show Wolfpack is currently getting the same treatment. You can contact Prophecy Radio directly on Twitter at Prophecy Podcast or on Instagram, Facebook, and Tumblr at Prophecy Radio Podcast. You can also email us your long-form thoughts to prophecyradiopodcast@gmail.com. You can find our episodes on Spotify, Apple, or any of your favorite podcast platforms. Please consider leaving us a review or a rating. 5-star reviews help others to find us, and that's always a really big help. You can leave us questions, comments, ideas for episodes you want to hear from us in any of these places. We love hearing from you guys and seeing your thoughts, and we definitely want to hear, if you guys read Spirit Glass, what you're thinking, because we really loved this story, and it's just another banger from Roshni, so we're totally on board there. Next week, we're going to be talking Red Pyramid predictions. We're going to do our final chapter of the Red Pyramid for now, chapter 22, and we'll be stopping there. And we want to take some time after we do the chapter to talk about what we think is coming ahead. It's like right at the halfway point here. And want to see if we can make some predictions.
Yeah. And I also want to say that next week is episode 99, which means the following one is 100. So if you've got stories to share about how you came across Percy Jackson, about how you found our podcast, about us in general, if you've been following us since Hypeable or any of that kind of stuff, anything you want to share, any cute stories about the podcast, listening to it throughout these last couple of years, it's weird to say that, please send them in wherever you can so that we can discuss that on our 100th episode.
Yeah. And we are looking forward to both kind of wrapping up some Red Pyramid for now, as well as diving into all of your 100th episode thoughts in the next couple weeks. So until then, this is Kristen.
And I'm Karen.
And we're Prophecy Radio, signing off. Over and out.